Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Krause. I hope you're staying happy, healthy, and safe. It's a big show, so let's get right at it. Later on, we'll meet Canadian business executive, publisher, art collector, fundraiser, and philanthropist Salah Bashir, author of a memoir called First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous. It's available now wherever fine books are sold. That's a little bit later on. We'll also get to know best-selling author Susan Fletcher, author of The Night in Question, which is being described as a lyrical and emotionally engaging novel infused with mystery and wisdom about love, friendship, and the power of forgiveness. First, though, let's spend some time with C.J. Tudor. She is an author of The Burning Girls, The Other People, The Hiding Place, and The Chalk Men, which won the International Thriller Writers Award for Best First Novel, the Barry Award, and the Strand Critics Award for Best Debut Novel. Her latest book, The Gathering, is a detective investigation about a grisly crime in rural Alaska who finds herself caught up in the dark secrets and superstitions of a small town. C.J. Tudor joined me from her home in England to tell me about why she chose to write a book about vampires and much more.
I love vampires. I mean, who doesn't love vampires? You know, they're just a great kind of monster, but partly because they're so human, I think. That's what's great about them. And I've loved vampire stories and books and films. One of my all-time favourite films is The Lost Boys. I love things like Near Dark, 30 Days of Night, Let the Right One In. But as I said, there's been lots of different interpretations. And I wanted to do a vampire novel, but I had to, for me, I'm like, I can't do it unless I can bring something new to the genre. And I didn't want to write twinkly vampires. I wanted them to kind of be more kind of brutal, kind of feral vampires. I didn't want any of that kind of like, I didn't want any of the kind of sexy vampire nonsense in it. I wanted to come at it from kind of a different angle entirely.
And is that where the Alaska setting comes from?
Well, yeah, I mean, 30 Days of Night is a great vampire film. This is not that. It's a very different story. But Alaska is obviously a great setting. There's something, I think, about the cold and the dark, particularly sort of, you know, over winter Alaska, you get that very long period of darkness that really lends itself to a vampire story. And also an isolated community, particularly in The Gathering, made sense for this story, to have this very isolated small town. I mean, because the setup of The Gathering is essentially that in this world that The Gathering is set in, vampires have always existed alongside human beings throughout history. But due to kind of superstition and fear on behalf of the human beings, even though vampires largely pose no threat and mostly exist on animal blood, human beings have hunted them and persecuted them pretty much into extinction. So there are only a few groups of them living in kind of remote colonies in remote areas around the world. And because of this, they've been given protected status. They're essentially an endangered species and they are protected by law, except if they should pose a threat to human life, in which case the powers that be have the authority to cull the vampire colony to make sure they pose no danger to humans. So into this kind of background, we have this small Alaskan town called Dead Heart, and this young boy is found brutally murdered and all the blood has been drained from his body. And it echoes a killing from 25 years ago that was a vampire killing. And the residents immediately presume there's a colony of vampires that live in an abandoned mine in the mountains, that they must be responsible. But they have to go through the process of investigation. And so into this comes Barbara Atkins, Detective Barbara Atkins, who is a specialist and basically a forensic vampire anthropologist. And it's her job to determine whether this is a killing by a vampire, because she then has the heavy burden of authorising a cull of the colony, or whether there's something else going on. And of course, there's something else going on, and this small town has lots of secrets and conspiracies, and there's all sorts of things going on. So that's kind of the starting point for the book.
When you're writing a book like this, which has so many elements, you're reinventing vampire mythology, there may or may not be a psychopathic killer involved. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of things happening. How much do you plan before you write the first word? Are you someone who sits down and writes a very detailed treatment, or does it, didn't know you're shaking your head now?
Yeah. No, I'm not. They say you're either a plotter or a pantster, don't they? You fly by the seat of your pants and make it up as you go along. And I am definitely the latter. I like to just dive into the story. I have a starting off point, and I always write when I have an idea the first chapter and a little outline about it. And that's my kicking off point. And then I kind of like let the story take its own course in a way. So I had an idea what this would be about, but lots of the story just evolved as I wrote it. And the kind of the vampire mythology in the book evolved as I wrote it, and the backstories. And for me, that keeps it interesting, because I always think if I'm kind of surprising myself as I go along, then hopefully the reader will also have surprises as they go along. And it does involve, perhaps, I think, that process you end up going back and editing quite a lot, because I'll have an idea halfway through and go, this would be really cool to do. Oh, but that's going to affect things in the beginning of the book, so I'm going to have to go back and rewrite that. But I think that's part of the process of editing anyway. A friend of mine who's a writer, the wonderful author Stuart Turton, described his process of writing as trying to build a book while it's actually floating at sea, trying to build a ship while it's actually afloat at sea, basically trying to put all these bits together and stop it from sinking.
You're listening to CJ Tudor on The Richard Krause Show. Her new novel, The Gathering, is available wherever fine books are sold.
That's kind of a good description of how I write, I think, as well.
Tell me a little bit about reinventing vampire myth, yes. Because we all know the classic image of Dracula. We all know The Lost Boys and, you know, the other films after Near Dark is great. All the films that you mentioned, and they are embedded in our heads. So yeah. If you want to reinvent that, you have to borrow a little bit, but.
Oh, yeah.
There is a certain baseline, I guess, that has to be there.
There is. I mean, the vampires in The Gathering, I suppose they're much more sort of, I'd say, feral. They've kind of been forced into that existence to a way. The vampire colony in The Gathering live in an abandoned copper mine in the mountains near this Alaskan town. And they, you know, they're because of the sort of the rules of this world, they can't work or really exist with humans. So they have their own traditions and their own kind of rules within this colony. But I didn't want them also to be too otherworldly as well. So also in The Gathering, although they live for a long time, you know, hundreds of years as opposed to our decades, they're not immortal. They're not undead. They describe them as, you know, they have different physiology, but they're not undead. You know, they can survive injuries we can't. They can recover from things better, but they're not sort of mythical creatures. You can kill them, etc. The odd stake through the heart, but you know, I think as my detective says at one point, if you staked a human and cut off their head, you'd kill them too. It's so they're kind of like they're much more mortal creatures, and that was important because I kind of wanted to almost get away from them being too supernatural. And sort of a species in their own right. There's different sort of, you know, things that go on. For example, you know, because they're persecuted, a lot of the vampires, you know, their distinctive teeth don't come through till they're sort of, you know, go through, you know, puberty. But a lot of vampires file them down because of, you know, having persecuted and hunted and try and hide who they are. So there are lots of the great thing about writing a book like this is that you get to make up your own rules in a way, and you get to kind of like create this whole world. And that was a lot of fun, kind of looking at all these are the myths of vampires. This is kind of what, you know, we ought to know about vampires. How can I keep the essential essence, but make it something more grounded and real in this world, which is kind of what I want to do. So they can't turn into bats. They can't disappear in a puff of smoke. They can see themselves in mirrors. You know, they're real. They're the kind of species that exist alongside human beings, essentially.
Well, I think that is, generally speaking, what sets really good speculative fiction apart from the pack, is that while it may be set in a world that doesn't exist or with creatures that don't exist, the universal story of it, yes, generally speaking, you know, can be, you know, much more humanity than not. Frankenstein isn't about just creating a big beast that lumbers around the castle, you know.
Yeah.
To do that, you're able to weave through hot button topics, I guess, and give it a maybe not a more contemporary feel, but certainly give people something more to chew on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think genre and speculative fiction does that really well. You know, it asks questions of ourselves. Whereas if you'd set it kind of in this society, it could feel a little bit like perhaps you're lecturing people or coming down on sides. But it gives us it takes us out of ourselves and allows us to examine issues that perhaps we don't think about, or we take perhaps sides on in real life, if that makes sense. And you know, it was really interesting to do that, because the vampires did, you know, provide a good a good interesting group to study how we sort of, I say, deal with people who, you know, we deal with people who we see as others, people, you know, who we see as different to us. You know, there's obviously within this town of Deadheart, there is this also this enigmatic preacher. And she's an interesting character because obviously, you know, as far as the church are concerned in this society, you know, vampires are still the spawn of Satan and, you know, should be eliminated and destroyed and killed. And so there's, again, you get that kind of like the kind of evangelical kind of Christians rubbing up against the kind of the woke liberals who think they should be protected and, you know, looked after and left alone. But, you know, also, you know, you get the view of the townsfolk and the other viewpoint is that it's very easy to be liberal and conservative and when the wolf isn't at your own door, mm-hmm. you know, these people have to live alongside these vampires who, you know, they see as a threat. And again, I think, you know, there's always different viewpoints on things. And all those things I was able to sort of tackle within the gathering. And it was really interesting and fun to do that. And I hope, you know, it doesn't come across in a heavy handed way at all, because it's, you know, woven into the story, which is at its heart. You know, it's a murder mystery with vampires. Someone asked me to describe it the other day and I said, I don't know, True Detective with vampires. That seems right. Like a pretty good description.
Yeah. CJ, thank you very much. What a pleasure to speak to you.
You are welcome. Thank you very much.
That was CJ Tudor on The Richard Crouse Show. Her new novel, The Gathering, is available now wherever fine books are sold. Later on in the show, we'll meet Canadian business executive, publisher, art collector, fundraiser, Salah Bashir. He's also the author of a memoir called First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous, and it's available now wherever fine books are sold. That's a little bit later on. First, we meet award-winning British novelist Susan Fletcher. Her new novel is an absorbing whodunit that also looks at and celebrates the passions, regrets, secrets, and adventures of one woman's extraordinary and inspiring life. We began the conversation by talking about how Susan knew she wanted to be a writer from age 11. Susan Fletcher joined me via Zoom from her home in Stratford-upon-Avon, England. The connection between reading a book and being a writer, I think when you're 11, is kind of tenuous.
Sure. I know that I'd always been interested in reading up to that point. I had loved books. I'd loved going into the world of literature and imagining I was somewhere else. But I can pinpoint the moment where I wanted to be a writer down to being 11 years old, because I went on holiday mm-hmm. with my mother to a sheep farm in rural Wales, and it was completely unlike where I grew up, which is just south of Birmingham in the central, in the Midlands. And I had a wonderful time there. It was a farm stay. We helped with the sheep and bringing the sheep in and all the various animals, what have you. And it came to going home, and I realised that taking photographs of these things that I had loved would not be enough, because a camera could capture something visually, but a camera couldn't capture the sound of the ditches with rainwater running through them. It couldn't capture the smell of the barn. And I remember really specifically that the sheepdogs were held in a cage at this farm. And if you put your palm against the cage, they would come and lick your palm through the wire. And I remember thinking how grainy their tongues were. And you can't capture that with a photograph. So I sat down and I started to try and write about these things in the hope that I could take it back to Birmingham with me and I could relive being in Wales over the course of the coming year. So it was a really clear moment in my life when I realised you can actually take something with you if you write about it. Take a landscape, take a person, take a feeling. And I enjoyed doing it. I realised even aged 11, I was okay at it. Wasn't good at maths or science, but I seemed to be quite good at doing this. And from that point onwards, I started to write, you know, kept painful teenage diaries like we all do, started to write short stories just for fun, and it grew from there.
And you were a little afraid of rejection for a long time in your writing. So you're writing short stories. Were you showing them to people?
No, I was very, even now, actually, the same applies. I was quite secretive about my writing. It feels very vulnerable in the beginning. I feel like whatever I'm writing is like a house of cards and one person just having a gentle prod at it and the whole thing will fall down. So I did keep it very much to myself, and I probably only really started to show my work in my late teens. When I left college, when I was 18 and leaving to go on to university, I submitted the first piece of creative writing that I can remember anyway to the school. magazine and it was accepted. So even though I'd been writing since 11, that was really my first attempt at going public with it, I guess, if you like.
Do you remember what that story was about?
Well, it was actually a poem, because even though I'm a terrible poet and I no longer try to do it, poetry is one of my first loves, because I love the language, I love the rhythm, I love the idea of trying to capture a feeling or a place, or in as few words as possible, just distilling it right down to the bare bones. So I love that poetry, and I try to do that in my writing. Whether I succeed is not for me to say, but I did attempt to write a poem about the school that I was leaving, and I would probably prefer not to look back on it, but it made the magazine anyway.
But it seems to me connected to the very first write-in that you did, in that it's sort of a sentimental look at something that you weren't going to be seeing every day again, was part of your life, and you wanted to kind of hang on to it.
Do you know, I'd never thought of it before that way, but you're absolutely right. It was the same thing. It was a form of farewell, I suppose, and trying to keep something with me, almost a degree of elegy to it. But yes, that preservation of keeping something close to you. And I try to do that with the books I write now. I love, as a reader, feeling transported to another place or another time, or really feel like I'm amongst these characters. That's what I love as a reader. So as a writer, that's just what I try to do to my best ability. Absolutely.
You're listening to Susan Fletcher on The Richard Krause Show. Her new novel, The Night in Question, is available wherever fine books are sold. And this new book, The Night in Question, came out of the lockdown.
So you're absolutely right. Lockdown happened here in the UK. And at that point, I was living on my own in a little first floor flat. And like all of us, anxious, afraid, not sure what was going to happen. And I thought, right, how can I make this slightly easier for myself? And I turned to words. That was the first thing I wanted to do. And I put to one side the book I was working on at the time, which is, to be honest, was pretty miserable. And there was enough misery out there. And I thought, no, what I want to do is create somebody who's going to be wonderful company. At this point, I had no idea when I'd next be allowed within 2 meters of another person. So I thought, I will create somebody who's going to be a wonderful person to wake up to and talk to and be with, somebody who is genial and good-natured and humorous and witty, perhaps a bit naughty, the kind of person who would move a snail off a path so nobody trod on it. You know, somebody who would just make me feel happier about the situation. So I knew I wanted that. But I also decided to write about a character who was going to be significantly older in their later years. I'd always been tempted to do that, because I quite like writing about characters, particularly female characters, who are slightly overlooked, slightly to one side on the periphery of society. And unfortunately, I think we can say that quite often the older generation can be seen as peripheral. But here in the UK, we had every night at the start of lockdown, we had these terrible nightly reports on people who had died that day within 28 days of testing positive for COVID. And we had the general population, a figure given for that. And then separately, we were given care home deaths, the number of people who died in a care home. Even speaking to you now, I'm not quite sure why there was a separation made there. But it felt in some way to me like we were being told those care home deaths matter a little less. There was some feeling about it. You know, I don't know why they were portioned off. And that made me, I feel quite emotional talking about it now to you, because it got me really upset then, and it still does. And I just thought, well, they don't matter less. You know, all deaths are a tragedy. And I very much wanted, therefore, to create a character who wasn't only great fun and interesting and humorous, but I wanted her to be older. I wanted her to be significantly older. And I wanted to be able to say, look at this woman, look at this life she's lived, look at the value she still has to society. She is so textured and complicated and rich. And so from that, Florrie Butterfield was born.
I think that the theme of the book is that it's never too late. There's all sorts of very, I think, uplifting messages that can be taken away from this.
Thank you. That's absolutely what I intended. First of all, for myself, you know, again, there I am in lockdown. I wanted to believe that actually the best was still to come. There would be a time beyond this that would still, you know, be full of light and laughter, and we would be well again. But I very much wanted to suggest, why shouldn't there still be adventures ahead of us? Why shouldn't we still, even at 87, as Florrie is, why shouldn't we still fall in love? Why shouldn't we still make brand new friendships, learn something brand new about the world, have potentially the best adventure of our lives, and in her case, solve a crime? So, you know, it's never too late. I know that we're all getting older, you know, and I do see that happening around me. I notice it. I can't jump down off a wall now without my ankles going. You know, we're all getting there. But actually, a friend told me a really lovely metaphor that I can't claim for my own, but I loved it. And she said that we should compare people to museums or galleries. So that if I was to gather all the museums and galleries of the world, all the best ones, the Uffizi or the Met or the British Museum or the Hermitage, put them all in one place, that one place would still not be as fascinating or interesting, rich as one human life. You know, there's more beauty in a human life, more art, more pain, more sorrow, etc., than all these museums combined. And I loved that idea. And of course, the older you get, the bigger your museum, because you've been having all these experiences. So I wanted to present Florrie her life and to say, look at everything, look at all the rooms of her museum. And why shouldn't there still be some more rooms to come?
I think that that extends to your other characters as well, though. It's not just Florrie who is layered and textured. You've got a minister, I guess a vicar, you would say, who's got tattoos, used to work in a bar, that kind of thing. There's some texture there as well that you might not expect. Florrie's nurse is a goth girl who has a bit of a past. So, you know, there is a lot going on here character-wise. So tell me about creating these characters. And do you know them before you start to write the book? Do you know who's going to populate the book? Or do you come to them as you write and work your way through the manuscript?
That's a really good question. With this book, Florrie herself came to me almost fully formed. I could see her quite early on and I knew who she wanted to be for the reasons I've already said. Everybody else, I think they sort of walked in. I mean, I knew, for example, that I wanted Florrie to, she's in a care home, in a assisted living home. And my experience of that, I've had a grandmother who was in a care home, is that the staff often are young. The character you've mentioned, the goth girl, she's Polish. You know, that happens a lot in the UK. So I knew I wanted her, and I could see her quite clearly. The vicar was a bit harder to come by because it would be so easy to have a cliched vicar. And I just thought, well, you know, why not? Well, let's play with him. Let's make him a bit different. It is interesting. You have a sense, perhaps, of how someone's going to be, but they normally bring something to you that you're not expecting. And if there's a character I'm really struggling to feel or see, often I just play with the name. The name is often a very big indicator as who they're going to be. And you suddenly think, that's her name. Right now I can see her. And that sort of makes me sound half mad, but that tends to be for me.
No, I don't think so at all. I think that writers have very unique relationships with their characters. Douglas Copeland, who's a famous Canadian writer, I've said this many times on the show, but he says that when he's writing, it's almost as if his characters are sitting on his shoulders, whispering in his ears what he wants or what they want him to write down about them.
Fascinating. Yeah, I can believe that. I mean, sometimes I think I know if something's not happening, if I'm finding it hard, there's something wrong and I have to just go, right, step back from that character, maybe get rid of them. You know, occasionally you think, oh, I think I need to kill this character. I think actually they're going to die. And then you feel very guilty about it for an hour and a half, but you think, well, actually, if that's what needs to be done, that's what needs to be done. But it is really lovely when somebody surprises you and they just walk in and you think, I didn't anticipate you, but I can see how you would work. You're necessary to the plot. You're going to be fun to be with. That can be a lovely thing when you're surprised by a character. There's somebody who you didn't expect and up they pop.
Tell me about the women, not only in this book, but throughout your books. Your work has threads of women's relationships woven all the way through, that whether they are mothers, daughters, wives, whatever it might be. And oftentimes it's about, I think anyway, what it is to find where you belong. as they go along the journey that you create for them at all stages of their lives. Flory happens to be in the later stage of her life, but it's not always that way in your books. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think a sense of identity and who we are is I think it's probably always been interesting to me.
You're listening to Susan Fletcher on The Richard Krause Show. Her new novel, The Night in Question, is available wherever fine books are sold.
Whether I've been consciously aware of that, I'm not sure. I look back now at my early 2, 3, 4 novels, and I see that this is a theme, and I don't think I knew it. but it is, for me personally, one of the things I've always really benefited from and does me wonders is being out in the natural world and actually being on my own. I think a lot of writers are the same. We need to be on our own. So there's a lot of thinking time. And I look back and I think, okay, I want to be a writer. That's a bit different to everybody else I know. Nobody else wants to do that for a living. You know, I'm self-employed. I've been quite peripatetic. I've wandered and lived in different places, which I've loved. But I've probably always felt a bit peripheral and a bit strange, hence my interest in characters who feel the same way. And actually, the older I've got, the more I think we probably all feel that way. I think everybody at some point goes, I think I'm a square peg in a round hole.
There's more people outside the circle than there are in.
Absolutely. And you don't realize that for quite a while, do you? So having sort of made that connection, it made me want to write about it all the more, because I think that's where you make a connection with the reader. And as a reader, which I consider myself to be first and foremost, I love it when you read something in a book and you think, I thought I was the only one who felt that. You know, that sudden light bulb moment where you think that person's just put down in words a little secret feeling I've had for years and never shared. And that's lovely. You feel that the writer has reached out and held your hand for a moment and you're all in it together. So to be able to write with candor about feeling on the edge, feeling unsure, feeling like you've made mistakes, hopefully that will be actually a lovely thing for the reader, because we've all been there. We've all felt it. And Flory definitely feels that. She's 87. She looks back on her life. Much of this book is an account of her life. And she does have times where she just thinks, gosh, look at all the mistakes. Look at all the things I wish I could do again.
Oh, you automatically assume that by the time someone gets to be 87, 77, 67, whatever it might be, older in life, that they've got it all figured out. And then as you start to reach those ages, you go, I still don't know any more than I did when I was 27 or 37, really, about a lot of things.
And you suddenly realize we're all just winging it. Yeah. Even the people who look like they know what they're doing, the people in suits, are all just making it up as we go along.
Where did you work as a cheesemonger? You said you had a lot of unusual jobs. Tell me about that one.
That was great fun. So I'm speaking to you now from Stratford-upon-Avon, and there was a wonderful cheese shop that closed during lockdown. But I've nearly always had to support myself with other jobs, doing other jobs to support my writing. And actually, I've loved being able to do that, because I've chosen jobs that take me out meeting people, amongst people. I mean, you have to enjoy people to write about them. So I've done a lot of bar work, waitressing, chambermaiding. I was a warden up in Northumberland on Hadrian's Wall, looking after an archaeological dig. Loved that. Amazing. And I love a job where I learn things. And I just saw that the cheese shop was looking for a Christmas temp, because everyone wants their cheese at Christmas. So they needed an extra member of staff. And I just loved it. So I went in there thinking, well, I really only know cheddar. That's all I know. and very quickly,
it's a good one to know. If it's the only one, it's not bad.
And that was just huge fun, because first of all, you are learning a huge amount. You're eating a lot of cheese, which is also great. And you're meeting people all the time. And when you work in a shop that's deemed a speciality, most people walking into that shop only knew cheddar. So it was quite nice to be able to say, let me talk to you about this cheese or this cheese or this cheese. So, and actually it there's a flash of it in the book. I felt it'd been such a wonderful part of my life working in that shop, and I'd gained so much from it. Thought I'm just going to just drop a little seed in the book. And Flory has her own experience of a of a cheese shop and her own love of cheese.
That was best-selling author Susan Fletcher talking about her book, The Night in Question. Loved talking to her all about the book, and, well, I like talking about cheese as well. I told her about a place in London in Covent Garden that has like a big sushi belt that just has cheese going around, and you take the plates as they come past you. One of the greatest meals of my life. Can't remember what the place was called, but it was really good. Let's meet Sala Bashir, author of a new memoir, First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous, available now wherever fine books are sold. Sala is a Canadian business executive, entrepreneur, publisher, art collector, fundraiser, and philanthropist who has raised millions of dollars for charity and says the only autograph worth having is one that's on a check. He's a pioneer in consumer video, the founding member and chair of Famous Players Media, and later the president of Cineplex Media and creator of the Scene program, which I know you've all used. It's a storied career, which he covers in the book in 54 short chapters about people he's met and befriended over the years. Chapters like Elizabeth Taylor Tries on My Pearls, Eartha Kitt Is Not for Sale, Wooing Gregory Peck, and much, much more. Sala Bashir, join me via Zoom. The idea for this book was born when you were in the hospital. You were recovering from a kidney transplant. So tell me how that led to what we're talking about today.
I got sepsis from the kidney transplant, and I had to have a few other surgeries, and it was life-threatening. And I was around for about 5 months between the operation and rehab, which was incredible. Bridgepoint, Toronto General, best in the world. And I started writing little anecdotes of stories I've told before just to lift people up and almost to tell my story as well to my friends and relatives. And then it grew up into this book. And so, little things that we talked about, like, you know, Ella Fitzgerald wanting to know where to get kibbe in Toronto. And of course, everybody's going to say my mom. And so we'll be delivering, you know, kibbe to Ella Fitzgerald, the Imperial Room, or Paul Newman when Joanne Woodward was at the Royal Alex, you know, in Sweet Bird of Youth. And I'd say to Gino Empey, you know, I've lived down the street if they ever want to come. I had an apartment at Simcoe Street across from Murray Thompson Hall. And, you know, they did come. And so these little friendships are born, and it's away from the camera, away from the role they're supposed to play. And
it is truly a memoir. It's about you, but it's also about these famous people that you've met along the way. But you're telling stories that I thought often were very funny, showed a different side of these very famous people. Elizabeth Taylor coming to your house to try on some of your jewels and that sort of thing.
And she took a cab from the Four Seasons down to the apartment. You know, you just have to wear those big glasses because those eyes, you're not going to get that everywhere. And yeah, and most people also forget or don't give her enough credit how smart she was about her art, her jewelry. Mm. Fact that she worked through a lot of surgeries and pain during her career to just keep going on.
You humanize these people that you're writing about and yourself rather than kind of lionize them. Why was that important to you?
I think most people don't see these people beyond their screen presence, what they mm-hmm. did and what they did with their celebrity, and that it's a role people are playing. And I didn't want to necessarily worship or, you know, I would say, always said that the only autograph worth getting is on a check. And, you know, and that's still true. I guess transfers now probably yeah. that works.
How did the book change while you were writing it? So it started off as a project while you were hospitalized, and it started off as stories to entertain people. Tell me a little bit about where the depth came from.
Well, I was working with Jamie Bernard, an old friend I've known for 40 years. She was a former film critic for both New York Daily News and New York Post. And then she brought it out of me when we fought back and forth. I would write something and she'd say, I know you had a deeper relationship with Edward Albee than what I can get at Wikipedia. It was like, I'm not going to write about that. So she pulled it out of me as well. And, during COVID and career stuff, I was going through a change, and most of these people had been, some of them were dismissed for their weight or their presence or they're too old to do anything kind of thing. And so the more she helped me pull, the more I wanted to write my own story instead of something you can get anywhere else. And so Well, just be able to tell my story through people I've met. So I thought that was unique as well.
You're listening to Salah Bashir on The Richard Krauss Show. His book, First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous, is available now wherever fine books are sold. Let's talk a little bit about your love of Andy Warhol. There's a reason why you collect them.
Yeah, I mean, Keith Haring introduced me to Andy Warhol. And that's even funny to say out loud, actually, because, you know, you never know, like, who's going to become what they're going to become, or, you know, and that's the whole point of the book. And he knew I called my mother twice a day, and he had, you know, and I adored Warhol because he broke all the rules, like every single rule. Like, people would, you know, want to know about his sexuality. He'd say, I'm a virgin while his husband, Jed Johnson's in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Or I'm asexual, or I ate, you know, Campbell's soup for 20 days or 20 years of my life. It's like, no, you didn't. But he'd play around, but he also revolutionized art in every way. And not only the Hollywood portraits, but he had a whole, like, sex series before, and the riots and transgender people, you know, portraits. So I adored Andy, and most people, you know, have not given him the due. I mean, incredible due that what he did, but he also left a lot of his will to his charity, the foundation, which has raised a ton of money for galleries and given, like, hundreds of Warhols to. So he revolutionized everything. And I loved the way he did everything. So, and Keith Haring, I mean, Keith, there's a little chapter in the book, which there was a special relationship there. Keith and I had a little fling together, and Keith would have been 65 last year. So you always wonder, and I'm 68, you always wonder what would have happened if they did have a full life. A lot of the artists that we lost to AIDS and other stuff as well. I mean, that always haunts you. That always thinks, like, I mean, part of that is why I couldn't even read the book myself, because sometimes when I read it out loud, it just... I blame it on the anti-rejection drugs from the kidney.
It makes you, they make you emotional, do they?
I don't know.
You're not wearing your trademark pearls today. You're wearing a diamond necklace, but you say that pearls are your badge of courage. You say that in the book. Tell me what that means to you.
To be able to walk into a boardroom with a pearl necklace. I think sometimes it's visibility. It's like, I'm doing these things to anybody coming out or young people who are struggling. And then I'm being myself. There's no guessing. It's authenticity. And then we placed it as, like, rappers and gay people. But if you go back, royalty and everybody else, everybody wore jewelry. And then I don't know how to tie a tie. To be honest, like, seriously, one time we were having a meeting with Blue Mappel with Mercedes and for Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research. So I went to my concierge and said, Grant, can you help me tie this tie? And he said to me, Mr. B, are you going to a funeral? I said, let me go back up and put my pearls on. And so, you know, that for me, it's just individual celebrating, you know. Mm-hmm. Being individual, being his style, who I am.
You've been listening to Salah Bashir on The Richard Krauss Show. His book, First to Leave the Party, My Life with Ordinary People Who Happen to Be Famous, is available wherever fine books are sold. Big thanks to Salah for stopping by and telling some stories. Also, want to give a big shout out to CJ Tudor for coming by, telling us all about her book, The Gathering, which is available wherever fine books are sold. Also, to Susan Fletcher, her great new book, The Night in Question, is available wherever you pick up your favorite reading material and books. As always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krauss. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay safe, stay weird, and we'll talk again soon.